This is XTP Media.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
You're listening to Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 38 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me in the studio today are my good friends and presenters, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson.
Hello, everybody.
And delighted to have you back, Gareth Stringer, Editor of Global Aviation Resource.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Hello, Tim, and hello, everybody who's listening.
We missed you last episode.
Don't make me well up this early.
And this episode, we're going to focus a little bit on the aerospace skills crisis that's been highlighted by the Royal Academy of Engineering report, the Universe of Engineering 2015. And it's been analysed by a colleague of yours, Tim, Rosalind Azuzi, who was a guest on one of our earlier shows. So we'll come back to that shortly. We've got an interview with Dr. Stuart Gray from University College London on a new approach to graduate training, as well as a great discussion on space debris. We've got lots of get involved feedback. We've got another new X10 top 10 from Tim. Now, Tim, the last one got us a lot of feedback, probably the most we've ever had. We've got some more today. And that, of course, was on carrier aircraft. So we're looking forward to this one. You've got a lot to live up to.
Yeah, this one will be even better or worse.
Top 10 paper aeroplane.
So the carrier aircraft proved to be a really, really popular one for debate and feedback. I mean, it's still coming in, so we'll get around to that in the Get Involved section. Amy's got us a new pods challenge, so we look forward to that as well. So there's a lot to get through. Let's get cracking with what's caught our eye in the news. And Tim, Gareth, let's start talking about this skills crisis. Engineering for us in the UK, I think, with our aerospace engine industry looking to blossom, the Americans and in North America, they're talking a great deal. There's a great aviation article in Aviation Week about the pilot shortage. A lot of their pilots coming up for retirement. We're seeing massive growth in Asia. It's lots of conflicting stories, but Roz has done a great job of bringing some of the key issues for us in the Aerospace Insight blog.
Yeah, I mean, it comes from a report from sort of engineering, let's say Royal Academy of Engineering, and it's basically saying that the UK needs 1.82 million people with engineering skills from 2012 to 2022 in order to remain competitive and fill all these gaps, retiring, industries expanding, so double the number of engineering apprentices and graduates. So that is a big ask to do. There is work ongoing. The Royal Aeronautical Society, along with other organisations and the government, is trying to sort of, trying to fund the the drum and you know, get kids in interested in STEM, get kids interested in maths, engineering, all the rest of it. You know, like you sort of say, it's conflicting in some respects. You know, we had last year, for example, we had the case where you know, Rolls Royce, for example, was you know, made a little put out an announcement saying they were actually cutting down on people,
yeah.
But yet they were still recruiting.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously the replenishment, they're getting fresh people. They wouldn't need to get fresh people in, but that sends out a kind of a weird message to you know, teachers, careers advisors, parents. Is, well, you know, if these big companies, you know, like Rolls for one or any others are you know, cutting down or making job cuts, is this really a kind of a good industry to send my, you know, son, daughter into? And there's also an interesting thing, I think, from Ross's analysis of you know, some of the careers advice. You know, the careers advisors, they're not specialists, they're not experts in aerospace, they can't really sort of tell you, or engineering. You know, they're not sort of engineering experts. A lot of the time is sort of taken up by day-to-day, you know, admin stuff. So they're really giving out, you know, basic sort of kind of careers advice, maybe on what they did as a sort of a, you know, at university, what their sort of, you know, sort of, specialist subjects were. So that's a real, I think, you know, maybe a real thing to you know, sort of challenge is how do you educate the educators, if it were.
Yeah, and one of the key messages to come through from all of this is that, yes, we do need pilots, yes, we do need astronauts, yes, we do need engineers, but we also need an awful lot of other functions within the aerospace business, you know, in the airlines, and also in the forces as well. We've seen the RAF in the UK advertising heavily for all sorts of roles, very attractive advertising. And Gareth, in terms of the military angle on this, are our forces struggling from what you're hearing to recruit people into the Air Force and the Fleet Air Arm and the Army Air Corps?
I think it's a very, very interesting question, Peter. Obviously, we are approaching yet another defence review,
yeah,
which I think most people seem to think. Yeah, I think a lot of people thought that SDSR in 2010 was tough and that was going to be the worst of it. Now, I think most people you speak to are predicting that this year's is going to be absolutely brutal. Now, in terms of aviation specifically, obviously we have less aircraft, than we have done for a long time, I guess. And you're quite right about the advertising. You know, you don't have to be a pilot to fly in the RAF. You know, that is the phrase that you keep seeing. But also, big push for the reserve forces, and that's going to be the same,
yeah,
for the army. And it's funny, as you were, you know, you're talking about commercial aviation. Of course, there's, you know, those two things can buffer against each other.
Yeah.
Joining the commercial side of things can be very appealing for a military pilot who perhaps has done his or her time, or is reaching a sort of natural break point in their military career. You know, certainly financially, dare I say it, it's usually a good move.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's probably a bit more civilized and all those sorts of things. So those two things can sort of buff up against one another. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how all this pans out. And I just hope, and two things that really came to mind for me, you see lots, as Tim, you referred to, we see lots about STEM and trying to get kids interested in everything. And, you know, it's, I guess the ongoing struggle with that is to make it cool, you know, and make it, it's got to be a desirable, you know, it's a horrible word to use, cool, but, you know, it's got to be a desirable thing for young men and women to want to pursue as a career. And it's probably, you know, not the most interesting, you know, not necessarily the most obvious career that you can do that with. So I think people are going to have to work very, very hard to do that. And I just hope, you know, it's such an exciting time, particularly in the UK with the growth, the sort of aviation seems to be coming back, and certainly space is coming back, and satellite technology and all those sorts of things. I just hope that it captures enough people's imagination that growth can continue for the next 10, 15, 20, onwards. It would be a terrible shame if that growth slowed down or came to a halt because we just didn't have the people that were interested in getting involved.
I think there's one more, observation I have with the military sort of skills and also the civil sector is that, obviously defence budgets are under a pressure and the temptation there, only last week we saw the first element of the SAR H go to Bristow helicopters, which will replace the Royal Navy and RAF Sea Kings doing search and rescue. It's commercial service. The temptation there is for politicians and the MOD. Well, we'll contract this out. We'll get the same service. It'll be cheaper. Brilliant. Jobbed. That'll save some money from the pot. Brilliant. But the problem here there is that you fail to realise that a lot of the sort of skills came from the military sector who were trained up at Her Majesty's expense, who then went on to be, SAR crewmen or helicopter pilots and off-sea helicopter pilots in the civil sector, supporting, say, the offshore industry. So there is going to be a stage when these civil, contractorized arrangements run out of these skilled people. Yeah. And all of a sudden they're going to have to, hang on, we need to train a whole batch of people from scratch, the same as the military do.
Yeah, it's a good point. Two things I'd like to add to that. The first one's a very personal one. I'm very grateful for those offshore pilots. They've just flown my son to Piper B. He's on Piper B for a week. So God bless them. And secondly, of course, the pinnacle of particularly the military pilots that we have in this UK, in the UK, is of course our very own astronaut going to the International Space Station later this year, Major Tim Peake, who was of course an Army Air Corps test pilot. So the old adage of the best rises to the surface, I mean, really proves there, and genuinely a lovely chap, but the best in his class, and he's now the top of our spear, should we say, in terms of our aerospace industry. So good luck to Tim. Okay, let's move on to some other news stories. On the military side, Gareth, you've been busy. You've been to the Air Show Symposium, but there's been a lot about the Fleet Air Arm and the Navy in terms of news recently. Global Aviation Resource had a great story on some changes there, but we're also seeing our pilots testing the F-35s as well.
Yeah, it's a bit of a naval theme and a bit of synergy, I guess, with what we were just talking about with Sea King retiring as of early next year, and that is with a small caveat that some of the ASAC 7 Sea Kings based at Cold Rose will continue, but also the Lynx will be gone by 2017 from the Royal Navy as well. So two very familiar types disappearing, which is always sad. But then we've got Wildcat coming on board. We've got the Merlin transitioning across. Obviously it's now fully under Navy control in terms of the green Merlin, as we would know it. What was the RAF Merlin? Wildcat coming on, as I said. And actually, I noticed even just today that a whole bunch of pilots and crewmen finished their Wildcat training. I think 18 pilots and crewmen from 847 Naval Air Squadron, and I think it's 652 is the Army Air Corps Squadron, all finished their conversion to type training on the Wildcat. So expect to see Wildcat a lot more, including with the Royal Navy Black Cats, who will be flying a pair of Wildcats for the first time. on the airshow circuit this season. So that sort of transition from the Lynx has reached its sort of natural conclusion with the Wildcat coming on board. So yeah, so that's all good. Whilst we're on the subject of Yeovilton, we must just mention the Royal Navy Historic Flight, because I know how dear that is to to your heart, Peter, as well as lots of other people. We are not too far off, touchwood, having a one of the Swordfish airworthy. It should be ready for the start of this season, and keep all your fingers and toes crossed it could be joined by the second Swordfish a little bit later this season. So that would be fantastic news. And also huge congratulations to Goaty, to Chris Gotka, who was awarded the Air Force Cross last week for his very, very skillful handling of the Sea Fury incident at the Cold Rose Air Day last year. He's a top man, is Goaty, very experienced pilot, test pilot, and that was fully deserved. And yes, F-35. We have to mention it, I think, pretty much every episode. But it's funny that, you know, the news does seem to be ticking over, and it's getting closer, I suppose, slowly but surely. We're obviously still hopeful that the aircraft's going to come over to the UK this year for the Royal International Air Tattoo. But from a more operational point of view, ski jump training has commenced. We're now obviously operating the aircraft under UK control independently in the United States as well. So yeah, slowly but surely she's getting closer.
I wasn't aware, Gareth, that we were going to use the ski jumps. That was sort of news to me. Either I'd missed that one. Are we the only nation that's going to use the ski jump, do you know? Because I've not seen anyone else.
That's a very good question.
I've not seen anyone else lining up to do that.
Tim might be able to dive in. Are Italy on board with us?
Italy will get us getting some of their they'll get us some of F-35Bs, I think. It's a mixed buy for Italy. Is it Cavour and that has the, whether they have a ski jump offhand, whether they have a ski jump already.
Okay.
Right.
Something I'd have to look at.
Okay.
Yeah, bit of a blast from the past, though. It always just makes me think of Sea Harrier.
Yeah. It does. Just before we move on, just to add my congratulations to Lieutenant Commander Gok as well. As you said, Gareth, you couldn't meet a nicer guy. He really is a very, very genuine chap. So well done to him.
And he wasn't at the British Air Display Association / MAA symposium last week, and then we all realised why.
Yeah.
When we saw him on the news.
Yeah.
So, well done, Goaty. Look forward to seeing you out and about this season.
Right. Okay. Let's move over to some civil news then. Tim, just before we move on to talking about Bombardier, great article you wrote about pilot training for the A350. Things are really changing. Some of the old methods and techniques seem to have really moved on with this new method. Do you just want to give us a little bit of an insight into how they're doing this?
Okay, right, yeah, so a four-page article in, four words? this is not just something that Airbus have just come out with out of the blue. It's comes from a lot of work on that they've been doing, that the industry's been doing, that various working groups have been looking at, that's all put in the melting pot, and it's conversion training for the A350. And what they are looking at is that they're updating the, aircraft airliner training really hasn't kind of moved on since the 1950s in a lot of ways. You know, the pilots are still training for things that are very, very, very rarely happen. You know, for example, an engine failure. An airline pilot can go a whole career now and not see an engine failure. Yet, at the same time, there's also this sort of mystery that still happens about, you know, fly-by-wire, what mode is the aircraft fly-by-wire system in? Is it in direct law? Is it in normal law? What are the computers doing? You know, and this comes out of, you know, recent accidents and incidents like AF-447, Colgan Air, The AirAsia looks a bit like that as well. We've had the TransAsia crash on ATR where it looks on the surface like the wrong engine was shut down. So they're now looking at they've now adapted their training system to give students more hands-on sort of experience in the full flight sim earlier in the course. It's quite a short course, but you get into the sim earlier, and you basically get a whole day there of what they kind of called originally flying school. Basically, to teach them that even though this A350 is filled with computers, loads and loads of jazzy screens and glass cockpit, it still obeys the same laws of physics as a Cessna.
Yeah. I think the key thing that jumped out to me, though, Tim, in that article was the fact that, and we've talked about this before. We talk about flight simulation. Of course, you've got the full flight simulators that are used for training frontline crews. But we're often asked by listeners, why don't pilots use flight sims to do part of their training? And that seems to be something that they're integrating here, giving them some access to, for want of a better description, PC type based flight sim well before they get into the main flight simulator itself, so that their familiarity is already sort of programmed into them. A lot of the procedural stuff they can do through a PC. And I thought that was quite innovative. Some people would say, you know, it takes away from real flying skills and things like that. But we're not talking about actual flight. We're talking about a lot of the procedural stuff that would take either a lot of experience to learn or a lot of reading books. But they're using technology to its maximum to try and give the pilot every edge before they get into that full motion flight simulator to learn the process stuff, so they're ready armed. And I thought that was quite innovative, quite risky, but quite innovative.
Sorry, Tim, I just wanted to just before you carry on, I just wanted to say there's some real synergy here with what you see at RAF Valley as well. If you go and visit the Hawk T2, that students are given you and I would call it a laptop.
Yeah.
Obviously, they call it a personal learning device. and they get that at the start, and that has things like they can do cockpit procedures on there. It even has a very basic sort of flight sim package on there. Once they've sort of played around with that and had the ground school, they go to this desktop trainer, which looks very, very similar to the to the fixed-based simulator, the picture of which appeared on your A350 piece, Tim, and they can go and use that kind of whenever they want, and then it all leads up to the full-on dome, 360 simulator. So yeah, you're absolutely right, Peter. That's it seems to be the way forward, clearly.
And what they're doing is they're trying to address the way in which the digital generation now learn, how you learn your new, when you get a new smartphone, you don't bother, no one reads the manual, you play with it,
yeah.
It's intuitive, and you and so they're really now trying to kind of make it learning sort of discovery and kind of fun, and concentrate really on the bits that the instead of doing it by rote and by checkbox and ticking it, they're like, okay, yes, really kind of allowing that simulator time, which is really, really precious. It's expensive. The simulators, the full flight simulators are in use all the time. So once you're in there, you really don't want to be kind of just wasting time doing stuff that the trainee already knows. It's to concentrate on the stuff that they don't know and that they're having problems with.
Yeah, no, it's a great article, Tim, and a great insight. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. We'd highly recommend that listeners go and have a look at that, particularly, as you say, with recent events in mind. As we record today, we're towards the beginning of March. We've just seen Bombardier flight test the CS-300. Tim, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, it's about time. The CS, the they've been, you know, at the moment they're going through a bit of a rocky patch. There's no doubt
Bombardier
about it.
Bombardier having real troubles, aren't they?
You know, the C-Series 100 flew in September 2013. You know, they didn't get to Farnborough last year. They had a grounding. You know, that was the other grounding, you know, along with F-35. That's obviously eating into their schedule. However, the CS-300 is the larger version. It's a stretch version. It goes up to, I think, 160 seats. That's the one that kind of eats into the A320 and the 737's kind of market share. So, you know, a good bit of progress there. You know, can they keep going, momentum going on that? Can they kind of make up lost time? Jury's still out, you know.
Yeah, they've got orders for a couple of hundred, haven't they? And they see the market size as being a couple of thousand. But again, they would have to really, really eat into Airbus and Boeing territory there.
Yeah, I mean, you look at I was at the Airbus annual results last week, and you know, they were talking about 2017. Just Airbus is talking about going up to 50 A320s a month.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's unbelievable.
So, you know, going up against that, and you know, Airbus and Boeing are being quite, you know, quite sort of direct about it when Bombardier came up with this Challenger, you know, that they... There was some sort of comments which were going to strangle it at birth. I'm not sure who said that, but that was a kind of, you know.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show how difficult it is going to get against these two giants. You know, if they'd been on time, if they'd been a little bit earlier, would they have more of success? Because people would be going, oh well, you know, C-Series sounds good. I'll take one of those. Now they're behind the curve. You know, they're playing catch up with the MAX and the Neo.
Yeah, and of course they've got, you know, other entrants as well that they're competing against. They've got the SSJ-100, which we saw some orders for earlier today, some more going out to Mexico. And although they're small numbers, these are really numbers that Bombardier want to be picking up.
And an interesting you know, sort of, market actually for China, ARJ-21 and its C-919. You know, we're all thinking, well, you know, Chinese domestic market, obviously that's a given. You know, Chinese airlines will have to take some of these aircraft, whatever, you know, that they'll have not much say in it. But also Africa. You think about how much Chinese has been China has been buying up, you know,
investing, Tim, investing.
Investing, you know, mining, sort of oil, gas, you name it, in Africa. And therefore that you know, you might think, well, maybe that would actually be
another big market there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Potential.
Here you go.
Potential.
I mean, you know, they'll probably get them dirt cheap. You'll probably get C919s at a absolute knockdown price.
Yeah.
But that would tie them into Chinese support, and that would be a nice, you know, kind of I wouldn't say a home market, but a nice sort of market that China can really exploit. Want to watch.
Yeah, okay. Let's wrap up the news then. I got one final story just on aerospace and space. We've seen Russia actually agree there to extend their ISS presence, but they're also shooting for the moon 2030. I don't know if this is more of Putin's rhetoric or not, but that looks like a bit of a challenge to NASA. But I also saw a story hidden away that ESA has signed an agreement with the Chinese Space Agency to become a partner with them. So the world is opening up, as it were, in terms of the space sector. And as we said earlier, great opportunities for everyone here. But the Russians aren't giving in, are they?
Ooh, yeah. I mean, they despite all the Cold War rhetoric on the ground, you know, we've always said that there's, you know, amazing amount of cooperation in space. You know, I mean, my question would be, given the state of Russia's economy, you know, they're getting a new spaceport built in Siberia. They've got a new rocket, a new launcher system.
Yeah, Baikonur.
You know, lunar missions as well. And if their economy is as much trouble as some of the analysts say, it might just be the best of best of the the alternative, well, we're going to pull out, we're going to go it alone, we're going to develop our own space station as a non-starter. So maybe it's just that, Moscow being pragmatic of, well, we paid for this.
Yeah.
You know, we've invested in it. Let's use it as much as possible. There's no point really in pulling out of it and losing that scientific, that technical investment, unless we really, really have to.
Yeah. So. Well, the Chinese have got their space station, of course. We've seen the Indians commit to a reusable space plane. ESA, of course, tested theirs last month. So exciting times. We'll leave the news there. And after the break, I get to talk to Dr. Stuart Gray, who's a lecturer in space geodesy at the University College London.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Bye-bye, Qatari 8271, send by 1-7. 3428,
hello, cross Zulu 2, then taxi via Quebec to Delta 53.
Cross Zulu 2 and Quebec for Delta 53,
two bird, 4-6. Information, Victor, Q81008, contact ground, 1-1-7, bye-bye.
Start up approved, 1-1-7, Los Angeles, Alpha.
631 Uniform Charlie, you are number 2 in the base, stand by short.
Alpha, ready to push, Bravo 1.
Lufthansa 8, Alpha, pushback approved.
Like tower 119.225 119.225 KLM 785 118.722.
Dr. Stuart Gray, welcome to Extended.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a delight to have you on the show. Stuart, I'm intrigued by your role at UCL, which focuses on orbital mechanics. Can you help us better understand this issue and your specialism?
Yes, of course. So orbital mechanics, or otherwise known as astrodynamics, is concerned with modeling the motion of objects in space. So yeah, this could be a mission on the way to Mars, or a satellite orbiting the Earth, or an asteroid moving through the solar system. So basically, we use the basic physical rules like gravity and drag and things like that to try and build up models of how these things move. That's the general field. What my specialism is space geodesy, which sounds very grand, but that's the, yep, basically the measurement of the Earth from space. So
right, okay,
we deal with like satellite altimetry missions, so measuring the heights of the sea surface or the ice caps. And in order to do these scientific missions, you need very, very accurate orbits. So our work is really tweaking these gravity models and drag models and solar radiation pressure models even to get the best orbits we can in order to give the best scientific data to the scientists.
Yeah, and of course we're talking about satellites here, and the work with some of the craft that are out there. Does this also involve models for future exploration projects as well?
Yes, well we do. Yeah, we could do some predictive stuff. So in orbital mechanics, there's basically two sides: there's orbit prediction or orbit determination, and we work with both. So orbit determination is you have some tracking data of your satellite and then you try and fit an orbit to it. But then with the orbit prediction, you just have a starting point leaving the Earth, say, and then you've got to have the best models possible in order to get a really accurate trajectory going, you know, towards Mars to hit that little keyhole for aerobraking, for instance, or something like that. So, yeah, we're doing some work with the Solar Orbiter mission, some very early stuff, which is a really interesting mission, and they're all the science missions are great. I really get excited about these sort of science missions. It's nice, like the bread and butter of our work is a lot of sort of positioning satellites and things, which is fantastically useful and kind of used by everyone. But it's these one-off science missions that are really exciting, I think.
Okay, so what's your favourite then at the moment?
I think my favourite current mission has still got to be the Mars Curiosity rover. I just think it's just absolutely incredible what they managed to do. And it's one of those things where the members of the public think that's incredible and people in the field think even more, it's even more incredible. It's just the feats of engineering to get it, because it's the size of basically a Mini Cooper, and they just landed it exactly where they wanted it. Everything's working as planned, apart from a few dents in the wheels. And I think it's just a really great scientific mission and a really great inspiration to future engineers, I think, because you can see the pictures it sends back. You can kind of relate to it a wee bit because it's a robot and it's moving around and drilling away. And I think it's just a great mission.
Yeah, and of course we've just seen the news in the last few weeks that that Beagle 2 did actually land on Mars, and it's in some ways very satisfying, because I think there was there's just been a feeling of failure about that mission, but in fact it's landed, and it looks like it was a comms issue.
Yeah, exactly. I think most of the solar panels are unfurled, so it might have just been one slight error somewhere, and then but it landed intact, and that was the hard bit really of that. Of getting to the surface of Mars is getting there intact. It's easy to hit it very fast, but the soft landing is the hard bit, and they seem to have nailed that absolutely. And I think it'll be, I don't know, maybe in the decades to come we can send a little rover to go and see what actually happened and see what it looks like.
Yeah, or even some astronauts, possibly.
Well, yeah, exactly. A few more decades after that, maybe.
maybe not in my time. Maybe in yours and our children's, but not at the moment. But, I mean, that's fascinating stuff. And I'm intrigued by navigation in space, actually, and some of the challenges that you as engineers and physicists face. With missions like missions to Mars, how do you navigate to such a precise point, given that there is such a big, I suppose there's such big scope for failure? And, ultimately, the universe is just keeps going. And,
So the first thing you've got to have is very good a priori models, so models you know in advance, so you want to keep down your maneuvers to a minimum, basically, with this thing. So you start off with the best trajectory you can get, and then you basically just constantly keep an eye, and any doing smaller, lots and lots of small adjustments is the key. It's basically constantly tweaking your initial trajectory as you go, constantly monitoring it,
right?
And then there may be depending on the mission, there'll be some scheduled burns, so you decide the size of that burn at a given time. But the navigation itself is all just done back from communications back to Earth. So when the Earth's spinning around and lots of satellites around it, we get some angles, basically make some triangles to the spacecraft. And as it gets further away, the triangle gets longer and longer and longer, so it's harder to really get the resolution on its exact position. But at the very start, you can get a really good idea, and that's when you really lock down the trajectory. And then hopefully going forward, it works.
It is just fascinating how accurate it has to be, though, you know, particularly going into orbit in somewhere like Mars, because the I suppose the braking maneuvers have to be as calculated as precise as anything to put it into the orbit of that planet. I mean, Rosetta, it's got no gravity to grab hold of, 67P. So how did they do that?
Well, that's
then?
It. That's if you see on the ESA website, there's some plots of its orbit, and I'm doing air quotes here, around the comet, because there is no real strong gravity to pull it round. So it basically just draws these sort of straight lines and changes direction and moves around and around it. And basically, it's just all the data they get back from the probe, back to the ground stations. And obviously with the Rosetta ball being an ESA mission, it's the work they do there is they get these tiny slivers of information, because the bandwidth coming back from a great distance is so small. And then they've got to infer from what data they get what's happening, and try and work out the relative position. And they spend all the time leading up to arrival at the comet, trying to work out better models of the comet so they can navigate their current position better. And incredible feats. Even back like in orbit of Earth, we have to have incredibly accurate orbits for, say, a mission like Cryosat, which is trying to monitor the ice cap height or depth. And so it's firing a radar down and bouncing off the ice, and you can measure the distance. So it's all a relatively simple approach, in theory. But the differences in the ice over year on year are in the millimeters. So you need to know your orbit to within the millimeters. So we have these spacecraft moving at kilometers per second, and the orbits we work with NASA JPL and ESA to produce are accurate down to the sub-centimeter level, because they have to be. And that still blows my mind, because these things are moving. Like if you're out by a millisecond, you're way out in position. It's incredible.
Well, you're the expert, and to see you're fascinated is fantastic, because I can really feel the passion coming through.
Well, that's it.
Where did that all come from then, Stuart? Where did your interest in all of this come from?
Yeah, so I'm a northerner. I brought up in Cumbria, in rural Cumbria, and we had proper dark skies. And I used to love walking out into the country, and there's a big reservoir out where I used to live. And you'd look up in a cold winter's evening and just see all the stars, see the Milky Way, see things moving around. You didn't know what they were. There weren't handy iPhone apps to see what that spacecraft might have been at the time. It was just you see this whole gamut of stars, and you know that there's spacecraft up, they're looking down. And it always just inspired me, really. And then that, and I read a lot of sci-fi as a young man as well.
Yeah.
In particular, the Mars trilogy by Kim Stanley Robinson.
Great books,
sort of quite hard sci-fi, in that they tried to be accurate for the time. They're probably a little bit dated now. I've not read them for a while, but they really inspired me of the possibilities of going to Mars and trying to build a colony and terraforming and all these outlandish things. And I think that really keeps me going. I really just love space stuff. I love aerospace generally, but space stuff in particular is something as a kid I always loved, but never thought I'd get a chance to do as a job. And then by a lot of very good luck and good timing.
I've seen your CV. I don't think there's much luck in there. There's an awful lot of hard work and a lot of studying as well.
True. But I think, and maybe we'll come on to this later as well, aerospace, like my undergraduate in aerospace, was mostly aircraft related. There was a small part of it was actually sort of as we call pure space stuff. And most of the courses were like that. And I think it's only now that we're getting quite a few more courses that have the real space slant to it. And it's becoming a bit more taught at undergraduate level and getting people a bit more excited a bit earlier, because it does seem very out of reach, literally and figuratively.
Well, let's talk about UCL then. They're starting a new aerospace course later this year. What can you tell us about it?
Yes, this is part of a larger scheme at UCL called the Integrated Engineering Program, where we have lots of engineering departments within the engineering faculty, so mechanical engineering, civil, electrical, for instance. And now they're all coming together to do a lot of lectures together. So the maths, for instance, and programming and things we all do together, and I teach some of that. And they're doing lots of interdisciplinary projects, right? Even though they might be an electrical engineer, they will work with mechanical engineers and computer scientists over the course of their degree. And as part of this, we're offering these engineering minors. So it's sort of the American model, where you have three modules where you can pick which area of engineering you want to look into. So you may be doing mechanical engineering, but you're particularly interested in aerospace, so you can do an aerospace minor. But the thing is, it's open to anyone. So if you're a computer scientist and want to do aerospace, you can do it. So this is a really interesting challenge, because you're going to make it accessible to any undergraduate engineering student at UCL, but also rigorous enough to actually really get through some of the harder stuff, because aerospace isn't the easiest domain in the world to get your head around sometimes.
No, and there is a real demand. You know, we've talked a lot on the programme recently about the growth in the aerospace sector, particularly in the UK, over the next decade or two. And the recent report from the Royal Academy of Engineering says that the UK alone will need another 1 million engineers and technicians by 2020. The approach that UCL is taking is slightly different, because one of the criticisms that's been on the academia is that it has been too challenging to get through that process, and therefore we've not spat out enough of those qualified engineers and physicists and the next Dr. Stuart Grays.
Yeah, so this is a perennial problem, really, in that to be an engineer, you need to have a background in maths and sort of physics and be able to manipulate these things at a relatively high level. But you don't have to make it as hard as people think they do. A lot of the more old-fashioned courses, sort of a maths course that was written in the 80s and things, there are all sorts of things in there that aren't really applicable now that we do a lot of our work as academics. Like, a lot of my work is programming, basically. I spend most of my time coding. And that's me as an aerospace researcher. And so we're teaching skills like that, along with the maths they need to understand the core concepts. And I think that can make it much more engaging and easy to get into, because rather than being hit with this wall of calculus and things, you're then given lots of little tastes of the different areas of maths. And you're put into practice, as in you're solving problems from day one using the programming languages we teach.
I recently heard an interview with you on space debris, and that's another fascinating subject and an area that you specialize in. How much of a problem really is space debris? We've seen, of course, the recent tranche of Hollywood productions. Pretty impressive, I have to say. Yeah. Pretty frightening.
Yes.
is the problem that great?
Well, I really loved Gravity, the film. I really enjoyed that, and seeing it in 3D was a brilliant experience for me as a big fan of space and sci-fi and things. So there is a space debris problem. It's not as dramatic as was shown in the film, but it's happening. There are collisions happening all the time. There's a lot of space debris out there, and a lot of it we can't track. It's too small to track. But these small items that we can't track can cause terrible damage to spacecraft and do.
Stuart, what can we track and what are we tracking at the moment?
Okay, so generally we can track anything over about the size of 10 centimetres. So that covers a lot
of... I'm just doing the measurement now. That's quite amazing.
Yeah, so that, exactly. That's an engineering feat in itself. And... very impressive in its own right. So we track over about 20,000 items of that size. And that's a lot of that size. And these range from fragments from collisions up to whole satellites that have gone dead. For instance, there's Envisat, which went quiet a few years ago, just failed. And that's about the size of like a school bus. And that's just still going, like, depending on the orbit and the size and dynamics of these spacecraft, they can stay up there for a very long time.
And Stuart, does gravity tend to pull them into the atmosphere where they're burn up, or are some of them too far away to eventually meet that end?
In low Earth orbit, the lower end of that, so we're talking like up to maybe 500 kilometers, the orbit will slowly degrade because of drag, because the atmosphere does extend. Yeah. It's very tenuous, but there's enough to slow it down slowly over a period of time, which then it falls and then burns up. Above like the top end of LEO, or low Earth orbit, and into the medium Earth orbit and geostationary orbit, there's no real drag effect doing that. So these will just keep on going, basically, as long as they're left there. So they could be up there for thousands of years in some orbits. So it is a long-term problem, and we have to, going back to our orbit prediction, we have to try and predict what will happen to these thousands of millions of items, actually, because we've just about 20,000 tracked like a greater than 10 centimeters, but there's a massive amount that's smaller than that, into the hundreds of millions of items, down to very small, less than a centimeter sort of size. And those, yeah, can cause damage, terrible damage.
Yeah, and I heard on that interview, you talked about a paint speck, yeah, that they believed hit one of the shuttles.
Yeah, right in the windscreen. And there's photos of it when it came down. So it took a chunk out of the few inch thick windscreen of the space shuttle. And this happened, like, these sort of things happen a number of times. And yeah, so the International Space Station has been built to withstand those small sort of impacts from paint flecks, etc. But the solar panels can't, and they're getting slowly degraded by hitting all these sort of very small items. And this is just literally a fleck of paint. Like, down on Earth, we wouldn't even notice it probably. But up there, moving at kilometers per second, the amount of kinetic energy is just incredible. And then something like a nut or a bolt would just go straight through whatever it collided with.
And so what's your role in space debris, other than purely of an interest basis, Stuart?
Yeah, so it's the precise orbit prediction, basically. So we develop lots of models, and I mentioned the solar radiation pressure force, which is something that basically the momentum of the photons striking spacecraft gives them a small push. And compared to gravity and drag in certain orbits, it's very small. But it has an effect. It pushes these spacecraft around, and we've spent a lot of years working on that. So what is important there is area to mass ratio, of course. So the normal spacecraft are quite dense and heavy. But a small bit of foil, for instance, has got a great bigger area and is very light. So it's going to be pushed around by these non-conservative forces, as we call them, much more readily. So these bits of space debris are really affected by these forces that we've spent a lot of time investigating. So we're looking at using the sort of techniques and tools that we use to try to predict these, like the ice cap measuring spacecraft's orbits. We're going to use those same tools to try and predict very accurate orbits of space debris to see how they'll change over time. At what sort of height will they start falling into the atmosphere, or will they be pushed away by the solar radiation pressure, or all sorts of different options. So we're going to do some very big studies on that to hopefully try and push that forward.
and Stuart, the talking about medium Earth orbit and I suppose debris and satellites further out in orbit of the Earth, will this debris drift into further into space? Will it be a risk to, you know, we talked about going to Mars, but is that going to risk craft that go off to visit other planets and areas?
The big risk will be still when these spacecraft that will be going on big missions in the future, as you can imagine, in the proper sort of site, will be constructed and staged from low Earth orbit, and the risks will be there, where there's a much higher density of debris.
Right.
There's as you move further out, the density falls off quite rapidly. There is a geostationary orbit, because that's a particular orbital altitude. It's very dense and very packed with all these communication satellites. So there's a lot of debris there as well. But you can avoid that quite easily as you're going out. The big risk for sort of these future space missions will be when they're in low Earth orbit. And that's when they'll be very vulnerable, really.
Right. And do craft have to, do you have to navigate them through those debris fields?
The problem is we don't know where a lot of the debris is. But for instance, the International Space Station, on average, has to make one or two maneuvers a year to avoid debris that's being tracked and coming towards it. So if you've got a bigger space station, or you're putting together a larger project up there, you would have to have the ability to move it out of the way when something comes by.
Right.
And that's if we know what's going to happen. If there's suddenly a big collision, which has happened, then the amount of debris in a certain orbit altitude can just skyrocket. It can go absolutely massive very quickly. And then we've got to have the ability to get out of the way very, very fast.
Right. Wow. So gravity, really?
Well, the thing is,
maybe it was true.
I'm afraid not. The gravity, that was, they were trying to show a chain reaction of debris, which would happen, but it wouldn't happen that fast. It would happen over the decades, which the end result might be the same. We lose access to space if it's uncontrolled and gets out of hand, and we don't do anything about this problem. But it wouldn't happen, unfortunately. Well, actually, very fortunately for us, it wouldn't happen over the course of a 90-minute film.
And Stuart, just to take that point there, is there anything that we can do? I mean, we've looked at sails and fishing nets things like that.
So the number one thing is we've got to be very careful about adding more debris. So there are now rules and laws and regulations about what you can do with your spent stages when you're launching things and not having spacecraft in too long orbits if they don't need to be. So if you're launching a CubeSat for a student science mission and you only need 3 months of data, then after, say, 6 months, it should be planned to burn up, not to stay up there for 25, 50, 100 years.
Yeah,
the number one thing is to stop putting things up there, because a lot of it will, over time, over long, long time scales, be absorbed, you know, slowed down by the atmosphere and burn up. But number one thing is not put anything more. After that, the sort of debris where we're talking like 10 centimeter size shard of metal, for instance, of which there are tens of thousands, then those are hard to find and catch and remove. But then if you think about what's going to cause a lot of space debris in the future, it might be something like Envisat, which I mentioned, crashing into something else. So if you go up and launch a mission to pull Envisat down, then you're removing a big possible source of space debris from the equation.
Right. Yes. Okay. I understand. Wow. Interesting stuff. And I digressed from the subject I wanted to talk to you about. So let's just come back and remind people about the aerospace course at UCL. Where can people find out more about it?
Okay, so we're going to be we're building up to this. It's still in design stages, but people can find more at our Twitter, which is at UCL Aerospace. And I'd really welcome your readers' comments and views on what they would think should be in a modern engineering aerospace course. I really appreciate that. So we've gone out to industry. We have lots of industry people lined up, but more the merrier, really. I really want to get a feel for what people in the aerospace industry want from a modern aerospace course.
Right, okay. And we can follow you on Twitter as well, can't we?
Yeah, so that's at Stu Gray, so Stugrey.
Right, okay. Stuart, fascinating stuff. Thank you very much. We need more Dr. Stuart Grays out there. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, Stuart, fantastic guy to talk to. I could have talked for hours and hours and hours about his subject, about space navigation, orbital mechanics, and of course space debris. Fascinating guy. I've got a feeling he could be back on the show sometime.
Yeah, I mean, really, really good, really good. Interesting to sort of hear from him, and also the gravity, the sort of situation sort of outlined in Gravity movie. Yes, it's realistic, but it could take decades rather than kind of 90 minutes, as you said.
Yeah, and of course we saw only, I think, yesterday another explosion of an old satellite, so there's yet more debris up there. But I just thought it was amazing how much debris they could track and the detail that they could go to. But really interesting stuff. So we'll see if we can get Dr. Gray back on the show sometime in the future.
Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
Well,
7-2-2, hello, taxi Quebec Alpha 4-6, cross Zulu 2.
Quebec Alpha 46, cross Zulu 2, 7-1-7-2.
Stream on you from Charlie, startup approved, information Victor, hold position, contact ground, 1-1-8, QNH is 1-0-0-8.
Startup approved, cross
position,
QNH 1-0-0-8,
QNH
1-1-8, for coach, stop, please, 3-1 uniform Charlie, goodbye.
371 Alpha, give way to the British Airways from the right.
Give way to the British, 37 Alpha.
Stop morning, Tosca 31 Uniform Charlie, send Hotel 5, request pushback.
Is it Tosca 31 Uniform Charlie, after company, pushback approved?
After company, pushback approved, Tosca 31 Uniform Charlie.
Germany 7181, ready for departure from Echo 4.
Stand by, Germany 7181.
3428, stand by on 11.7.
117, 3428.
So, Tim, the last X10, our top 10, was a big success. Over to you for this show's.
No pressure. Okay, this month it is our top 10 fictional aircraft. Mystery aircraft that made you think, or reach for a reference book when you saw them in a film or a TV show, or read about them in a book. Are they real or are they not? Let's find out. At number 10, EB-52 Mega Fortress. Brought to life from a life by author Dale Brown in the novel Flight of the Eldon, the EB-52 Megafortress is a pimped-out stealth B-52 with twin V-tails, four engines and advanced ECM. It also fires air-to-air missiles. Fun fact, weirdly, although the book dates from 1987, almost 30 years later, the US is still mulling a turbofan engine upgrade for the B-52. At number 9, EDI Stealth. And the rogue drone with a heart, EDI, in the otherwise forgettable 2005 movie Stealth, which also features the FA-37 Talon. Having struck by lightning, the computer brain of EDI goes berserk, downloads the entire internet, but redeems itself in the finale, siding with the heroes. Fun fact from Stealth, the FA-37 Talon full-scale model built for the film was so realistic that it started rumours that the US Navy had a new secret fighter when it spotted on deck of a carrier during filming. At number 8... the rocket jetpack, the Rocketeer. What if inventor Howard Hughes had designed a jetpack? Is the question Indiana Jones-style aerial caper the Rocketeer movie asked in 1991. Cue lots of airborne action with GB racers, autogyros, and even a Zeppelin making an appearance. At number 7, Vickers Vandal, Biggles. This fictional amphibian biplane appears in the classic W.E.G. John's Biggles books, when the iconic pilot and his and chums fly during interwar adventures in exotic locales. A rugged adventure suitable for air and water landings, its closest match seems to be either a supermarine walrus or the Vickers Viking in Mark 4. At number 6, Blue Thunder. Introduced in the 1980s film and then TV series, Blue Thunder was a fictional attack helicopter thrown by the LAPD. It also had whisper mode, microphones and other cool gadgets. The film eerily predicted worries over surveillance and militarised policing, while the helicopter itself was a gazelle given an attack chopper makeover. At number 5, Thunderbird 2, Thunderbirds. Who says cargo aircraft aren't sexy? This green behemoth was always the go-to aircraft of choice for the humanitarian missions of international rescue. A modular design meant that its larger mission pods could be switched between before takeoff or the suitable equipment for the mission. Additionally, a VTOL capability could land anywhere. FAB. At number 4, Airwolf. Yin to Blue Thunder's Yang, Airwolf was another TV attack helicopter from the 80s, flown by the wonderfully named Stringfellow Hawk from a secret desert base. On a Bell 222, Airwolf featured pop-out missiles and guns, as well as defying the laws of aerodynamics with supersonic rotary wing flight. At number 3, the F-19 Stealth Fighter. Back in the 1980s, we had to guess what a stealth aircraft looked like. There's rumours of black aircraft and a missing number of US fighter designations combined to give us the F-19. This shape, which first appeared in a L'Oreal trade ad, was then picked up to be a plastic model kit and even a computer game. Its rounded wings and inward canted tails, of course, did not look like the F-117, but it did give people a first glimpse of what a radar invisible stealth aircraft might look like. At number 2, the Wing. An aircraft that never even gets into the air before it is blown to smithereens by a careless archaeologist. It's the Nazi Flying Wing in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Looking very authentic from all angles, this fictional aircraft once caused massive frustration in the Robinson household, where my brother, who had seen Raiders before me, was unable to identify this mystery aircraft, despite hours of pouring through all the World War II aircraft books we owned. And at number 1, Firefox. It has to be the MiG-31 Firefox, a super secret, super fast Soviet stealth fighter stolen by Clint Eastwood in the 1982 film. It's invisible to radar, yet able to fly at hypersonic speeds. While the real Russian aircraft of the day, the MiG-29 Fulcrum, featured a helmet-mounted sight, the Firefox featured four control weapons. Hence, Clint must think in Russian. The Firefox, which is based on intelligence reports of the real MiG-31 Foxhound, has to be the ultimate fiction aircraft. Fun fact, a younger me managed to finish the Firefox arcade Laserdisc game, which involved flying down fjords at insane speeds. To have the reaction times of a teenager again. That is my top 10 fictional aircraft.
Brilliant.
Do you think? Is there anything missed out there?
Brilliant. That's a great one, Tim. That's a great one.
That's
yeah, I love Firefox. Yeah, I can't argue with that. I've got one. It's a bit of a cheat, but I suppose it's along the Thunderbirds line. That's Space 1999 Eagle.
The Eagle Transporter, yes.
Yes.
That would be fictional spaceships, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, my brother had the Matchbox one, the metal one. I'm very envious.
I tell you what, the Angel Interceptor almost made it onto there.
Ooh, yeah.
That's got kind of an F-104 vibe going on there.
That's Captain Scarlet.
Yep.
Yeah. There's another one, actually, Fire Flash, which was from a Thunderbirds episode. It was a brand new Max 6
airliner. Yeah.
And without wishing to constantly drag this back to the Carrier edition, who could forget the MiG-28?
Yeah, I did. It did cross my mind.
Oh, that's brilliant, though. Absolutely brilliant.
Well, let us know what you think about our latest X10 Top 10 and Twitter, Facebook, email. Do let us know.
Send us your mystery fictional aircraft.
And I must say, even if you've seen the film, if you haven't read the book of Firefox, it's a really, really good read.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, excellent.
I'm sure you could pick up a cheap secondhand copy on Amazon or... Yeah, maybe click through Extended and buy it from there. There you go.
Oh, well done. Smooth. smoothly put. Just before we go, the EB-52, I'd forgotten about that. Good one, Tim. Good call.
Whilst you were finishing that list, I've just bought a copy of Flight of the Old Dog from Amazon. I haven't read it for years.
Yeah, no, it's a very good one. Right, after the break, we'll get back to hear a little bit more about what you've got to say, including some more feedback on Tim's previous X-10 on carrier aircraft.
Channel 722, Quebec behind the Austrian on the left, standby 11.7.
And the Austrian and 11.7, Channel 17.
Austrian 371 Alpha, you're number one for Quebec, standby 11.7.
Standby 11.7, number 1, 3, 7,
7181, ready, Echo 4.
Jeremy 7181, I'm afraid to have you at the beginning. Just reported ready. Continue for wake turbulence to full length.
Okay, continue full length, Jeremy 7181. AV 1 November Charlie, request taxi able Echo 5.
AV 17 November Charlie, that's copy. Taxi to runway 18 left, November 2, cross 27.
Roger, 18 left, November 2, cross 27, AV November Charlie.
Flabagaria 461, hello. Left on Alpha, taxi Delta 23.
Left Alpha, Delta 23, good morning.
Good morning.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the Get Involved and Feedback section of the show, over to your previous X10, Tim, but Dania says, hi guys, sorry, I have to respond to your list. Although I won't argue any plane and any order, I definitely think that we're missing the A1 Skyraider and the Vought F4U Corsair. So I suggest an X12 Top 12. fair cop to him. And he also says, for a future topic, I'd like to suggest talking to aviation plastic or diorama modellers. These hobbyists are creating some amazing things, and the detail and the historic perspective of them is very impressive. So, yeah, good point, Bert. We'll pick that up. Okay, Philip Griffin wrote in to us to say that he saw that the Bremont watch won the 2013 Best Aerospace Watch. I was wondering who the past winners and present winners were. And of course, as we said on an episode or two ago, we had postponed that due to the loss of a sponsor. And unfortunately, as no new sponsor or supporter has come forward, that is on hold. So I did respond back to Philip. But again, we'll put it out there. If anyone wants to help support us in this year's award, please do get in touch with us. We are not talking large amounts of money, just a little bit of help to get that going. Chris Davis wrote in about Amanda Harrison on our last episode, thought it was an awesome and informative interview, and hashtagged that keep on flying. So thank you very much for that feedback, Chris. Grant McCarron, of course, our very good friend at Plane Crazy Down Under, responded back to the comments about 787 seating. He said, no surprise that some people avoiding the 787. Jetstar Airways have over 300 in their 787-8s. Hashtag flying sardines. yeah, it's quite sad that, that aircraft is really being rammed in. Mark Maiden, of course, from the Maiden Flight podcast and great supporter of the show, is back in the air. He's got a new podcast out, and he linked us to a picture of his chariot. So he's back in the air. Well done, Mark. Congratulations there. Okay, let's move on then. We've got a new pods challenge from Amy. Let's see what she has to challenge us with today.
Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim, and everybody listening to this new episode of Extended. I have a new challenge for you all this episode, and seeing as it's my birthday in a week, I'm going to do a birthday-related question. It's a bit different, it's a bit more fun than more sort of a serious question, but I want to know, if it was your birthday and you could have a private display from any display team in the world, who would you choose and why? I think we all know who I'm going to choose, and that's obviously going to be the Dutch F-16 demo. But yeah, I'd love to hear your responses. Yeah, I'll see you all in the next episode. Bye, guys.
Well, Amy, thank you very much for yet another challenge. Not quite my birthday yet, but I was lucky enough to celebrate, of course, last year in the Tiger Moth. So, of course, the Tiger Nines would be nice. But for me, I really would like the Blue Angels. I'd really like to see the Blue Angels do a display for me. How about you, Gareth?
I cheated a bit because I listened to this earlier, so I've been giving it plenty of thought, and it's as ever with podcasts, it's a tough one, and there's lots and lots of possibilities, but you know what, chaps, I can't look beyond the Red Arrows. How cool to say that the Red Arrows came and displayed for your birthday. Best of British, and
particularly with their new colour scheme.
Yes, the new tail looks very nice. Well done to the team on that one. So for me, Royal Air Force Aerobatic Team, the Red Arrows.
Would they also skywrite your name as well?
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
Or a big heart.
Or a big 4-3 if it was my next birthday.
Yeah, well, they'd be writing for a long time if they were doing mine. So moving swiftly on. Tim, how about you?
Okay, so this is a fantasy... money, budget, and anything. No holes barred, isn't it?
Firefox, isn't it?
No, I think it would have to be the late great Ray Hanna in a spit.
Good choice.
Looking at some of his, looking at some of his videos, flying under a bridge, flying a Goodwood, shaving that bloke's hair off on the one that everyone looks clicks at, and also that flying the Mustang in Empire of the Sun. How could you not want the master? The kind of display pilot to give you a personal display in the Spitfire.
Well, well done, Amy. Thank you very much for that challenge. We put it back to our listeners then. Let us know who you'd like to see for your birthday displaying over your house. Hashtag Pods Challenge. After the break, we'll talk some promoting aerospace.
Hi, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian. And with me is...
Max Flight, and we're both from the Airplane Geeks podcast.
And we're so crazy about UAVs that we've decided that we needed to start a whole new podcast. Yes, folks, you're going to get an extra half hour a week of Max and I.
Yeah, David and I have been hard at work producing this new podcast that focuses exclusively on unmanned aerial vehicles and systems. And as David mentions, it's a weekly show, 30 minutes in length. We bring you news and opinions and industry experts.
And we've already talked about some very cool stuff. We've had a former Airplane Geeks guest, Jamie Dotson, on, as well as we have talked about UAVs staying aloft at 65,000 feet for 5 years. And we're trying to put a positive spin on UAVs. We're not trying to talk strictly about military uses, but the commercial uses as well.
So we invite you to take a look at the UAVdigest.com and give us a listen.
Or download us from iTunes. So we look forward to your feedback and hope you enjoy our new podcast. Again, that's the UAVdigest.com.
Hello, Qatari 271. Just to confirm, we are clear to cross runway 24 at Sierra 2.
Hey, sir, the runway is ready.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, UZ65 at Delta, yeah, if that's it.
UZ65 Delta Juliet, taxi Hotel 5, via Zulu.
Taxi Hotel 5 via Zulu, UZ65 Delta.
UZ76 Tango Papa, contact on the one decimal 8. Frans van 340, contact van 1-0-8, over.
Tutu, Alpha approved.
Alpha approved, thank you wel, 1-7-2-2.
Over to promoting aerospace. This week I got to speak to Rod Holmes from Twitter VForce about a forthcoming event. Here's my chat with Rod. Rod, welcome to Extended.
Hi, great to be back and speak to you again, Peter.
Well, it's great to chat again. We met back in, the summer of last year on the Yeovilton flight line, and you had the opportunity to introduce Twitter VForce. But for those who didn't get to hear that episode, can you just tell us what Twitter VForce is?
Yeah, of course I can. Twitter VForce was set up in early 2011. I was milling around on Twitter at the time, and was noticing the amount of activity to do with the RAS VForce.
Right.
So one day, just randomly, I thought, I'm going to put a hashtag and bring it all together and say, hey, let's do hashtag Twitter VForce so we can try and get all of the information that's going out on Twitter about the VForce all in one place. So off that went. It started getting a few little followers. The first main follower was XM655 up at Wellesbourne, and the chappie that was doing one of the feeds for them contacted me and said, hey, do you want to come up to have a look at 655? And couldn't really turn that one down. So I went up there to Wellesbourne on one Saturday and met with a chap called Dave Taylor, and basically from that day onwards, Twitter VForce was born. The website came from that day, and it's grown since then. It's basically now it's an online focal point for all things VForce, really.
And tell us what the VForce is then, Rod. What are the aircraft that you classify as the VForce?
The VForce are the main three V bombers that were procured via the government back in the late 50s, early 60s. Obviously, everybody knows the Avro Vulcan, which is, we've still got one flying now, obviously XH558. There's also the Hanley Page Victor. And the one that often gets forgotten out of all three, and I think it's probably one of the better ones, is the actual the Vickers Valiant.
Yeah. And of course, we got a fantastic example of that in Lusty Lindy
Oh, yeah, indeed. Lindy's absolutely superb. And speaking to Andre Tempest, Lindy's owner, if he had the chance and got all the certificates to fly, I think she would possibly go up in the air again, definitely, if the chance. It's never going to happen, unfortunately, but she is in that good a condition.
Yeah, it's great, and it's great to see the work that he and the team have done there. So a big shout out to them. They're great supporters of the show. Let's come back to XH558. Can you tell us a little bit about Operation Finningley?
Yes, another one of my off-the-cuff ideas that I just randomly come out with, and I either get told to shut up, Rod, you haven't got a clue what you're talking about, or this is maybe something we can work at. We decided to do another one of our anniversary meetups. We'd done our first year anniversary up at RAF Cosford, where we had a few people come along that were just invited guests only, and we spent the day looking around the only place where there is a full complement of V-Force planes on display. Yeah. And we thought, well, we've got to do it again at some point. What Finney is going to be is a chance for us to go up to Hangar 3 up at Finningley, or Doncaster Airport, but we've been allowed to call it Finningley, which is very kind of them.
Of course, in active service, that was its name, RAF Finningley, yeah.
It was indeed, yes, and XH558 was actually stationed at Finningley for most of her serviceable career, so it's quite an apt place for her to be. So yeah, I contacted the guys at the Vulcan to the Sky Trust, and just milled a few ideas, saying, look, is there any chance that we can, you know, organise a meeting? And they said, what sort of thing do you want to do? I said, well, an afternoon with 558. And they said to me, right, Rod, we'll sort out a date for you. You organise the rest. So the rest I have organised.
Okay, now it's Saturday the 28th of March, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah, 28th of March, and our allotted slot is going to be between 1,300 and 1,700 hours, so we have a four-hour slot actually up in the hangar itself.
Right, and who's able to go to that, Rod?
Anybody can go. Tickets are on sale now. There are various links on the Twitter V-Force website. They are being sold directly through the XH558 website itself, but there's no direct link from that website. You need to come through the Twitter V-Force website, and then that will relink you over onto their site to buy the tickets.
Right, okay. So anyone going along, what are they going to see on the day?
Indeed. Obviously, there's an Avro Vulcan there, which is going to be in the middle of a winter service, and potentially the reason why we chose to go up there is the last time that we're going to be able to be together as a group and see her in the winter service. So apart from her, we've also been honoured to have Craig Bullman, who's written the very successful book, The Vulcan B2 from a Different Angle. Craig's been dying for a long, long time now to do a presentation on the B2, but he's never really had the opportunity and the ability to do it as a mass group. I know somebody who knows Craig really, really well, and I put the suggestion, say, come on, let's have a go at Craig. Wouldn't it be an ideal chance for you to come down and give your very, very first presentation on the Vulcan at Finningley under the wings of 558? And he basically went through the roof, so he's really, really he's absolutely really excited to do that.
Right. It sounds like a really exciting afternoon. What sort of people do you think you're going to be able to attract to this? Is it the hardcore Twitter V-Force followers, or is this open to anyone with an interest in aviation?
No. Obviously, there's going to be a core band of Twitter V-Force followers up there, because as soon as they saw the tickets, they got straight online and bought them straight away. So like, the hardcore are there already.
We have to remind people that you just don't get access to XH558 very often. This is a true opportunity to see her up close, to maybe have a chat to some of the people working on her as well, isn't it?
Yes, indeed, yes. We're hoping to have some of the engineering team along there with us, even bearing in mind it is the weekend, so most of them probably do go home for the weekends. But quite a few of our followers are volunteers and tour guides up there. And they very generally said they'll come in for us so they can give us all the tours and the guides. We're very, very honoured, actually, because obviously the trust is 558. We've been allowed to extend it, so it's more of a celebration of the whole of the V4. So it's not just going to be, you know, obviously 558 there, but we've managed to get Andre Tempest along again, who's the chappy up at up at Elvington, who owns Lusty Lindy. He's coming down for us to represent Team Victor. And we've also got squadron leader Al Stevenson, who was an AEO on the Valiant squadrons, coming down as well. So we got a whole representation of the whole V force up there with us.
Wow, what an exciting event this is going to be. So tell us again, times, venues, how we can get tickets, and costs, Rod.
Yeah, sure. The event takes place on Saturday the 20th of March. Its official title is Operation Finningley, and it's Twitter V4/XH558 from a different angle. Tickets cost £20. Every single bit of money taken automatically goes straight to the trust. So every penny that you spend now on getting tickets and money you spend on the day goes straight into keeping 558 up where she belongs. Tickets are only available by going through our website, which is www.twittervforce.com, and go into the blog section, and there will be a link there which takes you straight through to the 558 payment screen.
Right. Rod, just before we go then, what is the state of 558? Is this going to be her last season?
It's at the moment, yes, it's being advertised. It is her last season. Obviously, nobody knows. The Trust have put out the information saying that 2015 will be her last flying season. And unless anything comes out differently, that's our word on it.
Right, okay. So again, a unique opportunity to get to see her and to have some fantastic talks on the other V-Force bombers as well. Rod, great of you to do this sort of thing and to organise these events. We can also find you on Twitter, can't we?
Yes, you can, yes. Our official Twitter V-Force account is at V-ForceHQ. But if other people want to see some of the other things I do, I do have an own account, which is at Rod558. But a lot of that, again, is all V4 stuff. So it gets tweeted out to the masses, let's just say.
Okay, Rod, we're going to help continue to promote this event. And do send us some photos and some information after the event so that we can throw it up there and support you as well.
Yeah, certainly we'll do, because we do have an official photographer with us on the day who runs one of the central regions for the Vulcan to Sky Club. So she's going to be putting out loads of photographs. So yeah, you'll more than get loads of them coming through to you.
Okay, she's so popular. She's really popular around the world. So let's continue to fly that flag. The spirit of Great Britain, eh?
Indeed, yeah, she certainly is.
Rod, thanks very much for joining us.
No, fantastic. Good to speak to you, and hopefully catch up again soon with you.
So if you want to get to see the Vulcan up close and personal for the third V-Force anniversary, Operation Finningley, Saturday the 28th of March. All proceeds, of course, goes to support the Vulcan, which is now confirming attendance at air shows. I think Yeovilton's confirmed, Eastbourne's confirmed. So she's going to be back in the air. We think this is going to be the last time, though.
Behind me, Bulgarian 319, easy, 111, Charlie. Ground to very easy, 76 Tango Papa on Zulu, heading to Zulu 2.
767, Tango Papa, roger, cross Zulu 2, then Alpha northbound to Hotel 6.
Cross Zulu 2, Alpha northbound to Hotel 6, 76 Tango Papa.
France 1 3 0, hello, cross Zulu 2, then via Quebec to Charlie 7. France 1340, to be sure, maintain Zulu at Zulu 2, continue to cross and then get back. France 1340, I need a read back, please, that you will cross at Zulu 2 and not the runway.
Yes, sir, we cross at Zulu 2, not the runway.
Thank you, sir. German Wing 7181, contact tower on 119.225.
19.225, 7181.
Delta 446, push pull approved.
24, thank you, 447.
Delta 1854, approach Quebec.
557, your rubric is correct, stay with me please. I didn't keep approval for startup.
Hey, Sam, 557.
Following on from the engineering shortage, the Institution of Mechanical Engineers School's Aerospace Challenge for the UK is now open. It's a unique opportunity for you to win a place on a free five-night residential course at the School of Aerospace, Transport and Manufacturing at Cranfield University in July. So can your school or ATC unit come up with ideas that justify a team of three attending Cranfield? All entries must be received no later than Monday the 1st of June. If you want to be involved in that, you can go to their website, which is aerospacechallenge.org. So a little shout out for them. After the last episode, of course, we had Philip Tarry, who was the chairman of ARPAS, on the show. Great interview, stoked a lot of debate. If you want to find out more about what's going on in the UAV, UAS industry, go over to the UAV Digest for all things drone. Great episode, great podcast by two of our close friends, Max and David. So a weekly program if you're interested in that sector. Now, back in episode 7 of Extended, we talked to Captain David Rowland about flying Concorde. Well, if you like technical details, another great program has just been published. This time it's from the Amiga Tau podcast and is another brilliant episode by Marcus Falter. He gets to talk to John Hutchinson, who's another Concorde captain. So listen to this, a short outtake of that program.
It's very, very fuel demanding,
yeah,
to have those reheats on. So there were only two phases in the flight where you used the reheats. One was for takeoff, and you'd have them on for about a minute and a half or minute and a quarter until you got to the noise abatement time. And then at noise abatement, you'd cancel the reheats and throttle the engines back to a predetermined throttle setting. And the other phase of flight where you used the reheats was for the transonic acceleration from subsonic flight through to supersonic flight.
Oh, yeah.
And you then, when you were ready, when you requested clearance from the air traffic controllers for your climb and acceleration to 50,000 feet, you had to have a completely clear, unblocked airspace all the way from 28,000 feet where you were flying at 95% of the speed of sound all the way up to 50,000 feet. You couldn't stop the acceleration process at any intermediate point. It had to be a seamless process all the way from 0.95 right the way through to Mach 2 at 50,000 feet. No stopping in the middle anywhere. So the air traffic controllers had to guarantee you no conflicting traffic through that whole block of airspace.
Now, John Hutchinson makes some very, very interesting comments, which we won't steal the thunder of from Amiga Tau, and we'll put a link to this program in our show notes, about how much longer he felt Concorde should go on for, and also some of the key reasons he felt that the aircraft was retired, which is not the story that we have all been led to believe. But I suppose the question I want to ask you, Gareth and Tim, is, was Concorde retired too early? You know, we're talking about supersonic transport being the next thing for things like biz jets, and there we go, retiring aircraft.
I mean, here's the thing. It really did. You think about the timing of when the accident happened. The BA were making money with it, but the timing was such that the accident happened, and the return to flight was in the middle of, during the investigation was ongoing and the return to flight and what have you. 9/11 happened, and people were, looking at air transport. It was all dropping off. We know now that the passengers came back, the traffic came back, but people were looking at that and going, this has torn the heart out of it. What are we going to do? Americans were saying, we're not going to visit Europe, transatlantic.
Yeah, they were particularly targeting France, weren't they?
Maybe if it had it happened at another time, had 9/11 not happened, maybe people there would be more, yeah, you know, let's get this thing back in the air. You know, we can still make money. You know, the security aspect hadn't been sort of tapped on. There might have been more, a little bit more, you know, desire or emphasis to get it back into the air and get it flying again. I don't know.
Well, as I say, John Hutchinson makes some very, very interesting comments about the retirement of Concorde in that program. But it's also a very technical program. So he talks through some real detail of how the aircraft flew and so forth. So if you're interested in that, we'll put a link to the program in the show notes. But it's the Amiga Tail podcast. And thanks very much, Marcus, for letting us play that little excerpt. Okay, Tim, over to you, promoting aerospace.
Okay, what have I got for promoting aerospace? This is a Kickstarter that is happening, and this is from the World War One Aviation Heritage Trust. Currently, as we record, it's got 2 weeks to go, so get over there fast if you want to help. And this is to get World War One aircraft airborne on the display circuit in the UK in 2015. Currently, they've got two BE2s, and they're now going to talk about adding to that with an SE5A, Albatross D5A, and a Sop of Snipe. And these are aircraft from the Vintage Aviator in New Zealand. So it's very, very rare that we get to see these things in the UK. Very, very rare indeed. Travelling a long, long way. If you want to see these aircraft on the display circuit in 2015, get over to the World War One Aviation Heritage Trust, put that in, or type that into Google and then type Kickstarter, and you'll find you should find their project to just give them a bit of support and give them a bit of a push.
Okay, and Gareth.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to something, bit of a family connection, quite close to my heart. This year is 15 Squadron Royal Air Force's centenary. They've just unveiled in the last couple of days. She flew today a spectacular, specially marked Tornado GR4 to commemorate the centenary. And it's 15 Squadron is currently 15 Reserve Squadron, the Tornado Operational Conversion Unit. It has been operating the Tornado since, I think, 1983. Previously, Buccaneers, Canberras, Victors. And that's where the family connection comes in, because my dad was posted to 15 Squadron as a technician when they took delivery of their Victors in 1958. My dad was called up to join the Royal Air Force. But John Nixon, who's the current boss, commanding officer of 15 Squadron, they're doing loads of fundraising. And John is running the 2015 London Marathon, having never done anything like that before, to benefit the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. You can find everything you need if you're not following him already. And we will put this in the show notes, but it's at John Nixon XV, as in Roman numerals for 15, and no H in John. Please go and follow John. He does little competitions, sort of short timescale little competitions on Twitter, where if you donate within a certain period of time, you've got a chance to win little piece of memorabilia from 15 Squadron and stuff like that. And he's well on the way to his target, I think. But you know, that's how to commemorate a centenary for a squadron. You know, roll out a painted jet, raise a load of money. And a nice nod to the history of the squadron as well. So well done, John.
And just finally, in terms of promoting aerospace, I want to get on my soapbox a little bit. You've heard a little bit about the Royal Aeronautical Society today. Of course, we play their promos in our show. The last program did come from the Society, and we're very grateful for that. I had a great time with Tim. But we don't often get to mention Global Aviation Resource and Gareth and the support that they give to this show. Without Gareth and Global Aviation Resource, this program would not exist. They support the program, they host our programs, and they financially contribute to keeping our website going and so forth. So for those of you who haven't been to their site, please do go and look them up. It really is important that we show some support to the people that are supporting the program. You guys are sitting, guys and girls are sitting listening to this. I'm sure you're very grateful that we produce this, but without both of those two organizations, this program would not exist. So do support our supporters. Okay, that's about it for this show. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions. Live ATC, the feed today came from Amsterdam Schiphol. Amsterdam Schiphol ground, actually, on a busy Friday morning. So we might just continue picking out an airport from around the world and playing you some bits if you like us to do that. We'd like to thank Amy Parkin, of course, for another Pods Challenge. And just a little insight, of course, she did mention it there. Happy birthday, Amy. When this show airs, it probably is around your birthday time. So happy birthday to you. You can now find Extended on UK Podcasters. That's ukpodcasters.com. You can find us on Stitcher.com and, of course, on iTunes. So we're around and about. And particularly on iTunes, we would like to say a big thank you to Clokey74, Dan Air, and Tedders123 for the feedback that you've left for us in the last couple of months. We do know that we still have a lot of new listeners and a lot of listeners who download the program through iTunes who haven't left us any feedback. You can do it anonymously, but it really does help our ratings. People cannot find the program and they're stumbling across it. So we're obviously missing out. We do need the listeners to find us, so please leave us that feedback. Okay, our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The program is produced with a Creative Commons license. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm at RESTimR on Twitter, and you can find the Society's site on www.aerosociety.com.
And Gareth?
Yeah, can I just say really briefly, Peter, I had no idea you were going to do that. Thank you very much for that little plug for
it's fully justified. We wouldn't exist without Global Aviation Resource and you financially supporting this program, so it's justified.
And lots of great pictures of planes and words about planes.
Yeah, you can never get enough nice pictures of planes, can you?
Absolutely.
Appreciate that. And can I just say as well, Amy, happy 21st. I know it's a big birthday and I know that you're incredibly excited and rightly so. I can't remember mine. It was such a long time ago. But
I didn't know we were allowed to say her age, but it's out now. So happy 21st.
It's out there, yeah.
Do we give a GPS coordinates as well then for you know everyone to kind of, you know, Dutch Air Force to go over and fly their F-16s.
Yeah, Dutch Air Force, Spitfires, Red Arrows, and Blue Angels. I think that ought to do it. You can find Global Aviation Resource at globalaviationresource.com, and you can find me at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter. Always good to talk about aviation.
Excellent. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk and, of course, also XTP Media on Facebook. And that's it. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
And although you had the opportunity to interview... God, there you go. Outtakes already. There you go. I'll start that again. Stuart, I'm intrigued by your role at UCL, which focuses on orbital mechanics. There you go. Can't get it out. I'll say that again. Okay, over to promoting aerospace. I got to speak to Ian Holmes this week about an event coming up to support the Vulcan in the Sky Trust. So here's my chat with Ian. Have we lost anyone?
No.
Tim? Yeah.
Maybe.
Tim.
Hello?
Oh, you're back.
All right, you're back.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.